Accession number 23329, reel 16.
Steen.
I thought the Russians would want to prevent evacuation by the Germans. I think we rather overrated Russian concern for British prisoners. On July the 13th, the move was announced, and the Americans were to move first, sometime during the night. There wasn't much time, and so not wishing all their belongings to fall into German hands, they decided to give them to us. So all their stuff was thrown over the wire into our compound. They hadn't warned us of their intention, and one or two people were hit on the head by tins of food. And then for the rest of the day, there was an absolute barrage of tins, books, clothing, sports equipment, cigarettes. And up till that time, there'd been a lot of trading across the wire and a lot of hard bargaining. And it was pretty ironical now that after all that haggling, the stuff was being just chucked over the wire. But we had to begin a scorched earth policy ourselves then, and it was heartbreaking when the library of 800 classical gramophone records, which we'd had for only 3 months from the Red Cross, had to go. And people, we anticipated that we were going to march quite a long way. We were wrong in that, but people were preparing for the march on that basis. Had they known that we were going to entrain at Heidekrug Station, they might well have taken more of their possessions with them. Anyway, the Americans went from the camp very noisily, and then a couple of hours later, they were marched back again. This gave us great heart. We felt that the Russians had got there first and had cut us off, but unfortunately, no such thing. So at 3 a.m., the Americans were on their way again. Again, shrieking and jeering. And the noise of the march we could hear for quite a time. Eventually, we quite missed the Americans. Their compound was left derelict, and so much had happened between the two compounds that it felt very funny that they had disappeared. Then K-Lager went, and the barracks in our compound began to empty, and after three more days, we were the only block. You might remember that there were nine rooms, if you like, in each big brick block. So we ate everything we could. In fact, we ate till we were ill. And then amid the wreckage of one hut, I found Mike Adams's little library, which on a shelf above his bunk, and he abandoned those lovely books, and I couldn't take them either. We were hanging around as long as we could in the camp, hoping that the Russians would pounce suddenly, or that their bombers would destroy the bridge at Tilsit. Then Ron Kennett, another young Canadian, in our barrack, asked if he could join our combine. We were a little reluctant, but we accepted him, and the combine actually was enhanced, I would think, by his presence. Morning came, and I remember Ron Davies, we used to call Pouchy for some reason, having his kit in swag form as carried by the Australian swagman, and it was a very comfortable way of carrying things, and was emulated by quite a number of others. We had destroyed everything we could. The great banners of toilet paper ran from the electric light posts. There was destruction everywhere you looked. In the Vorlager, where we assembled, there were Red Cross parcels, and we couldn't carry them as parcels, really. We ripped them open and selected the things that would be most useful, and stuffed them into our kits and our pockets. And some of the Germans we gave tins of food. Some thanked us warmly, but they were jeered by their comrades, who pointed out that as soon as we'd gone, they could help themselves to whatever they wanted. And then the German in the sentry box began to shout at his own compatriots, crying that they should be ashamed to accept charity from the murderers of their wives and children, and scavenging through the rubbish left by the Luftgangsters. Some of the soldiers called back at him defiantly. Others threw down the things they picked up, and then some of them changed their minds again as they moved away from the postern box and shoved tins into their knapsacks. Toby had a brainwave and went to fetch the laundry cart, and we piled our kit into that. And within seconds, a dozen men threw their kit bags on top of ours and then hurried away. We got the order to march, and we looked at each other and literally put our shoulders to the wheel. And as we passed the sentry box, we saw the guard was weeping with anger and mortification. Three men stayed in the camp. They were hidden in an unfinished tunnel. But other than those, Toby Dick, our new combine partner, Ron Kennett, and I were the very last prisoners to leave the Vorlager. There was a long column of marching men ahead of us, and a horse-drawn cart which was loaded with Dixie's office equipment. Behind us, there were six guards in a row, and each one had a hound on the leash. And we heaved away at the laundry cart with its tottering load of cuckoo kits.
at a fairly good speed because those dogs were snapping right behind us. Well, we left a derelict camp when we first arrived. It had been spanking new with green grass. And now the earth was powdered and grey. And, of course, littered with all the stuff we'd torn up and thrown, cardboard, clothing, cigarettes, and trails of powdered milk and jam. We kicked the gardens to pieces, and not that there were many gardens, but there were three or four plots tended by enthusiastic gardeners. Or maybe they just like vegetables. Toilet paper banners streamed from the electric light poles. It was an absolute scene of chaos. The Germans were lining the road outside the camp as we marched. Very hostile, some throwing stones. As we marched on, the crowds disappeared, and I noticed that already, after two or three miles, people who set out very ambitiously with far too much to carry had left stuff strewn along the side of the road, greatcoats, blankets, food, and there were marches to come that were to try them a great deal more than that one. Ahead of us somewhere were the men whose kits had been left in our trusting hands, or trusted hands. Four fools in the cart, we reckoned. The cart was showing signs of buckling altogether, and heaven knows what we would have done with the kits if it had. Bits fell off, and I retrieved them. And there were some records, and I don't quite know how they got onto our laundry cart. The papers, anyway, fell off. And by the time I collected those, a dog had a go at me and just missed me by the skin of its teeth. We got to the station. We were pretty exhausted, although it had only been a few miles. And we now watched by people from the town of Heidegroup. I think they were envious because they knew we were going because of the approach of the Russians. They were having to stay and face them. We were picked out by a German officer to load the kits. We were to act as a baggage party. It was a pretty big job because there were hundreds of kit bags and people would be standing anxiously watching as we loaded and careful with that one. It's got a picture with a glass in it. I'll put mine next to so-and-so. His is there somewhere. And don't think mine will hold together. Run the rope around it again, will you? And so, quite a job, but we were rewarded because as the prisoners were all drafted into groups of 60 to occupy cattle trucks which were labeled 8 horses or 40 men. We we were set aside until they were all loaded. Toby, who had sneaked off from the baggage party, now sneaked back in again. He tried to, but the German officer wasn't impressed, and we soon saw Toby's very disconsolate face peering out from the barbed wire. Right. As I said, the trucks were labeled 40 men, 8 horses. They were closed vehicles with small high ventilators, and at either side, in the center, were sliding doors. The Germans had put in partitions of wood and barbed wire, dividing the truck into three. There were 30 prisoners crammed into the cage at each end. And in the middle, area was occupied by 6 guards, and there was a door leading into each cage. We were still on the outside when all the prisoners were in their cages. We had a curious sense of freedom, but it didn't last long. We were still, of course, loading. I was standing on a pile of kit at one point. I could see beyond the station, and I saw horse-drawn wagons with Red Cross parcels coming from Stalingrad 6. I was delighted with that. I thought they were coming with us, but the wagons turned away from the station, and we never saw those Red Cross parcels. It was very strange because up till then, the Germans, as far as we knew, had never stolen a single parcel. This time, they were going off with 30,000. The 10 of us in the baggage party, and when we were boarded, we found that we had the same room as 30 men were occupying in other trucks, so our labors had been rewarded. It was quite a long time before we got going, and everybody was getting very thirsty. Requests for water were declined by the guards, not really because they were inhumane, but because no provision for watering us had been made. But some of the women on the platform, or started with one, sent her young son to fetch a bucket of water, and got a bar of chocolate as a reward, and so he needed no bidding to collect a second bucket, and within seconds all the small boys of the village were racing home to get buckets of water. Some of the prisoners who had unsympathetic guards were not allowed to have any, but most of the prisoners got some water. We were still hoping that the Red Air Force would destroy the bridge over the Niemen and cut us off. We didn't know that the men from K-Lager were going by sea, and if we had been cut off, no doubt we too would have gone by sea. We spent 36 hours in the train, often shunted into sidings to make way for troop trains going east, and hospital trains which were going westward. Also, there were damaged tanks which no doubt were going to the repair shops, and a certain number of the German troops that were going on leave, and they looked pretty battered too. The men who were going to the battle were mostly very young, almost as if they'd stepped from their Hitler Youth briefs into their field grey uniforms, and men who were a good deal older, and in fact looked as if they may have fought in the First World War. On one occasion we saw a trainload of Russian prisoners, and we hailed them, but they made no response. We went through Insterburg and Allenstein, Deutsch Eylau, and again we saw concentration camps. Dick noted in his diary that the Germans were obviously draining Poland of land wealth. There wasn't much stock in the fields, and the Germans seemed to be putting their axes to the woods. We went across the Vistula on a very long railway bridge and on to Thorn in Poland. We called it Thorn, it was Toren, can't remember what it's called now. It was dusk by this time, and the guards formed up on the platform, and the prisoners were detrained. We, the baggage party, and now had to unload the kit, and so men milled about trying to claim their belongings. The office equipment went on to a motor lorry, and a few cigarettes got us permission to travel on the lorry. Well, we put out our own kit, and we singled out Buck Buchanan's and Toby's and those of several others who we reckoned would help others on the way. The rest of the prisoners formed up in column for the march, and they were watched by some pretty Polish girls, which no doubt, well, not a question of doubt, it was quite a nice sight. Now, the way the German officers signalled for you to move off was to raise a clenched fist and then jerk it down, like a train driver tugging the whistle cord. And so as the men moved off, they were all making train whistle noises. And the girls laughed, and rifle butts were, or guards threatened them with rifle butts. It was quite a while before the lorry came for us, and we were pretty worried.
We were wondering if in the end we'd be compelled to walk and take all those kids with us. Anyway, the truck did come, and we loaded the kit and mounted it, and in that way were conveyed to the camp of about 6 kilometres away. It was a large camp, built in and around an old sand quarry, and already it was occupied by about 3,500 army personnel. And in fact the camp was controlled not by the Luftwaffe as we were accustomed to, but by the German army. There were 8 connected small compounds which were called Hofs, and as I said, it was a large camp, and the whole circuit around the inside of the wire was 2 miles. For us who'd been used to much smaller camps, it was like a ramble in the country. We had airy wooden huts and 24 men to each hut, but no facilities for cooking. And for the first few days we had no palliasses either. The cookhouse provided a midday soup, hot water for tea 3 times a day. It was half a mile from us through, and we had to walk through ankle-deep sand to get there. We did get Red Cross parcels, and they were complete and the tins had not been punctured. I probably mentioned punctured tins before. The idea, of course, was so that we didn't keep the contents for too long and didn't take them on any escape. We used to reseal them with a bit of greased paper. Now, some of the army men resented arrival, or perhaps not our actual arrival, but they didn't feel that we should have been included in the issue of parcels in the first week. They knew that many of the RAF prisoners had brought tins of food from Heidekrug. And in fact, the army prisoners never ever quite forgave us for settling in on them without bringing our own parcels. But as I said, they had been all looted and hadn't travelled with us. But on the whole, there was no real friction between the services. In fact, lots of RAF men made friends with army people. It was at least gave them a change of topics for conversation. And of course, the stale old stories that people had been telling each other could now be tried out on a new audience. One afternoon I was sitting doing nothing in particular in the hut when a very debonair company sergeant major in Australian uniform inquired for me. It turned out to be a man named Nielsen White, W-H-Y-T-E, with whom I'd gone to school in a little country town of Kerang in northern Victoria. He'd been captured in the North African campaign quite early on, I think, when a Rommel tank came right up to the foxhole where he was and pointed its gun down into the foxhole. He didn't get much choice. He'd been in Italy and was one of the many prisoners that the Germans moved into their camps when the Italians began to crumble. We had to adapt ourselves in many ways because army methods had never been ours. We weren't rank conscious as they were. And even in England, the army had never understood a system that allowed a wing commander to fly as a rear gunner under the captaincy of a sergeant pilot. At Salek,